Alison King, Reel 1. Can you tell me where you were brought up as a child, Miss King?
Yes, I lived in a lovely house in Forties Green, North London. 1 acre of lovely garden, cedars to climb, tennis court, the lot.
How many of you were there in your family?
Only my sister and I. She was 4 years older.
And what did your father do?
He had his own business of gems and things in the city. But he wasn't very businesslike.
Whereabouts were you educated?
I went to King's House School in Muswell Hill, for when I was very tiny. And then I went to Tollington High School nearby and didn't like that. So I left. And that's when I left at 14.
Had you any idea what you wanted to do for a career?
I knew I wanted to get to the top in one or two women's orgs. Or something like that.
In an organisational way?
Well, it's easier in a way. I hadn't got any money to start my own business, so, you know, I thought that's what I'd try and do.
So what did you do when you left school?
Well, I went to Germany to a dear family I'd met, mother and daughter, who taught me German frightfully well, and many other things. And there were lots of nice male cousins, which was also cosy.
What years were you in Germany?
I went to Germany every summer before the war, the 4 years before the war. And when I went there, and they had ghastly Hitler, I heard him talking from a balcony. I never heard such nonsense that he was saying, and how they could stand with their hands raised, I do not know. Because the family I met were not to do with him.
Had you any idea what things were building up to?
Oh, I thought, there was a dreadful atmosphere. I mean, one day this friend would take me to a cafe, and they were sweet, and we knew them all. And the next day there was a notice up. They'd found that they were not interested in Hitler, I presume. And we weren't surprised when we saw it. Well, she wasn't, anyway.
What were feelings towards the British like?
Oh, well, Magda loved the British because she was fond of me, and she thought the British were good. In fact, I met her in England because she wanted to come. This was long, long before the war. She wanted to know about the English a bit more.
So you were out in Germany for the whole of the summer, every year?
Yes, I could say that. I could say that. Might not have been quite the whole every time.
What else did you do in those years before the war?
I did learn to type and do shorthand, and it never was in the way because when I did my book, I typed it bang on the typewriter, and I was very glad. I had some quite nice little jobs, but it wasn't what I wanted, of course. So for 2 years, I fiddled about doing that.
What sort of jobs were these?
Yes, these were secretarial jobs, which I wasn't very keen on, but at least they helped me to go on and do what I wanted.
Can you tell me about your flying background, how you became introduced to the idea of
I
flying?
I just always loved it, the thought of it. And I used to sit at home with Mother, and I had been down to Malin's Airfield, where there was cheap flying run by a woman. And that's where I met Margot Gore, who was to become the CEO of the thing. And so I started to learn to fly in 1939. War interrupted, and so that was it as far as my flying was going, although I did have about 4 or 5 lessons, and it was very interesting to do.
What type of aircraft?
It was only a Tiger you learned to fly in.
And what were the instructors like?
The instructor was this woman, who also became, I can speak of later, she came in one of the other things. And it was jolly good of her, because, you see, none of us had much money, and so it was very useful.
How much did it cost learning to fly?
I can't remember now, all this time, but it was half of what you would pay elsewhere. And my family, although Mother didn't want me to fly because she was frightened of it, she'd give me the money, you know. I was that kind of age.
Your parents didn't encourage your flying?
Well, my father didn't mind. Well, Mother encouraged it, but Mother, because she liked me, loved me perhaps, but she was frightened of it for me. Do you see? She, you know. And
did you go on to take any of your licences?
Oh, my dear, I hadn't done enough. Oh, of course, after three lots of lessons, war started and everything was put to the ground. Every flying thing was stopped. Except the Fleet Air Arm and the RAF, of course. Yes.
Can you remember the outbreak of war?
Oh, yes, I can. I'll tell you why, in a way. Because these darling friends of mine in Germany rang me the night before it broke and said, "See you after the war, Alison." And I said, "Yes, yes, Magda." And so there we were, with a long time in between.
How did you react to the idea of going to war?
Well, do you know, I felt rather excited about it. I was always a bit punchy, I suppose. shall I go on then?
Well, had you any idea what women's role might be in this war, in the early days, this is?
No, I didn't know whether ATA was going to succeed. Pauline Gard was allowed to take in 8 women in 1940 to join the ATA, but they were just sort of nothing much. One never realised they were going to become what they did. So in 1940, for 5 years, I became the first woman operations officer in the country as flight captain operations with the women ferry pilots at Hatfield and Hamble.
Can I ask what you did between 1939 and 1940?
Fiddled around with one of these ghastly jobs, I expect, those little jobs. I expect.
You weren't involved in war work?
No. I can't remember it because it wasn't very much, you know. I don't think.
So how did you actually come to work for the ATA in the first place?
Well, when I was having this cheap flying, Margot Gore was there too, and we became quite friendly. And she was going, she went off and got her 2,200 hours, whatever what was they had to have, by working in a factory and paying off the money. So she was a pilot, but I wasn't. So Pauline, as I say, got these pilots in at Hatfield, but they were only flying, then they were thinking of flying Tigers. I think that's about Tigers and Masters. They're both single-engine aircraft, light aircraft. That's all they flew at Hamble. Sorry, Hatfield. Margot applied to Pauline if she could join Hatfield, and they said yes, and she said, "Oh, by the way, I have a friend down here." Oh, no. Marion Wilberforce, who was the second in command, had to stay behind and do the operations work, not fly. And she said, "Amy Johnson's sister," she had a little sister there, "is ill, gone off, she's ill." So Margot was able to say, "I have a friend down here. Yes, she can. I'm almost sure she can type." So they said, "Call her now." So I went in, and luckily I was in the room where the other person was, Marion Wilberforce, who was doing operations. And although I sat at my desk and was very good at trying to do what they wanted, I noticed all that she was doing. And after about a week or so, she was flying a little bit more, and I was looking after operations. And then there came the time when she said, "Could you do it all the time, if I weren't here, I mean?" And I said, "Marion, yes." So that's when I became the first woman operations officer who wasn't a pilot.
At Hatfield, this was a mixed ferry pool. Were you in charge of men's operations as well?
No, Hatfield wasn't mixed. Was it? I can't remember. Oh, yes, it would. I expect it would be mixed. I don't know, damn it.
I wondered how the men reacted to you becoming a first woman's operation.
Oh, well, they didn't know. I think it was purely women there at Hatfield. Men started their own ferry pools over the country, you see.
Can you tell me what your duties at Hatfield exactly were?
Oh, when I went in, I was just going to do the SOG. I mean, make bills out and type something and all that. But as I sat in that lucky room with Marion just there, she found that I could do operations because she went flying again.
What did an operations officer have to do?
Well, Pauline Gower must have said to her, she called me in after the fortnight and said, Alison, Marion says you can do operations very well. Would you be our operations officer? I said, oh, Pauline, yes, would I? I'd love to. So I did. And it meant overnight, we were given a program by ferry control, which dealt with all the ferry pools. We were given a program of aircraft, and of course, when we were at Hamble, it was only light engine, number one, as we used to call them. So then we flew them wherever they would go to, perhaps right up to Scotland in a Tiger. Pretty breezy in a Tiger. It's open. So that was it.
How many pilots were there at Hatfield?
Well, now, I can't quite remember that. I suppose when we left, and six of us went, I'll tell you, I suppose there were about 20, perhaps, or something like that. All women, and all most of them frightfully good pilots. And
who were the women pilots at Hatfield?
Well, when Pauline Gower was given permission to get her first eight, Winnie Crossley, I remember, was one of them. She was married, a marvellous pilot. Rosemary Rees, now Rose Ducrow, Joan Hughes, who was a very famous pilot on her own, Margie Fairweather, who flew with her husband, and both he and she were killed on different occasions. Poor Margie, she was desperate. And Gabriel Patterson, who had started the Hatfield cheap flying, and quite a few more. Do you want me to go on?
What sort of calibre were these pilots?
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. And can I just go on with this? Because I mentioned Winnie Crossley. The day that the women there were allowed to fly a master, anyway, a twin-engined aircraft, Winnie was asked to take it up. It was brought over by somebody from White Waltham at the head office, and Winnie was asked to take it up. She did a circuit. She came round and she said, "Lovely, my darlings. It's a lovely little aircraft," because she was about that sort of person.
How did they relate to each other?
Oh, well, you could. Well, I mean, they were friendly. Some they didn't like, some they did, you know, inevitably as life goes on. And there were more than those, but I've just put they all had flying ability of a quality.
By the time you joined Hatfield, there were more than these original eight.
Oh, more than the original eight, yes, indeed. And well, Amy Johnson joined Hatfield after a bit, and of course she was a marvellous pilot, absolutely wonderful. And the pilots all liked her very much, but they didn't press on her because she was so famous. And I think she quite enjoyed the freedom and yet the admiration she had. And she was always willing to give somebody a lift. If say she flew to Scotland, and someone said, "Amy, could you give me a lift back?" And she'd say, "Yes, of course I can," and she'd fly them back. And she flew me over to White Waltham one day. She was I don't know what she was going to do. I say a job of importance because it must have been, and I was going to collect something. And we went into the mess, and she couldn't have been more sweet. She bought me a drink, and then we were crowded by those of her friends and those who would be so, and I was pushed out. And she said, "Alison, come and finish your drink." So I did, with great pleasure. And it was very nice being able to talk to her on the flight going there and back. I wasn't able to there because everybody crowded in. And so we were only there a short time, but it was very, very nice and memorable flying with Amy Johnson.
Did she live near Hatfield?
No. Amy lived over near White Waltham, and she'd fly over daily in the Fox Moth to Hatfield. And
Was she involved in the same ferry duties as the other
pilot? Oh, yes. She's a bit more choice, maybe. But no, no, I gave her the things. I mean, I might say to Pauline, do you think... But I didn't. Pauline would glance at what I'd done and say I'd done all right. On the whole, she never asked me who to give what to. I knew their classes, when I say class, what they could fly and what they couldn't. And I can't remember, but I guess she came and looked at it just before everything was agreed. And then one morning she came in and said to me, that was after Amy was there, of course, she said, can you give Amy an Oxford to Scotland? One from here, one from Hatfield. And she'll get something back. Well, that was very unusual to me, because she might have given a reason she wants to go and see her sister-in-law or something, anything. But she didn't. And so I did wonder at that. And when war was over, anyway, I had a feeling in my mind that Amy had been on a secret mission. Now, could we go to tomorrow, the next day, where in operations in the afternoon, Amy had taken her Oxford and come back to somewhere in England, I thought. But I hadn't heard that she'd left. She put down, by the way, at her sister and brother-in-law's at Blackpool. So she spent the night there. And then the next day, I felt a dreadful atmosphere in operations. I just felt stiff with horror at something, I didn't know what. And then Pauline came in the afternoon and said, have you heard what's happened to Amy? So I said, no, I just checked round. And this is what has happened, I've just told you. She spent the night there. She took off from there. And I hadn't heard any more. That was that day. So Scotland had given her an Oxford, twin engine Oxford, to bring back to somewhere in the country. And I discovered, after the war, that Amy took the Oxford from Scotland, yes, over the Channel, collecting a German, I should think, utterly think, a German vitally important to us. And she was shot down on her way back by one of our boats in the estuary as she was coming from the continent. I was greatly in touch with the captain of that boat and was sorely angry with him. And he said, well, we thought it was a foreign aircraft. I said, you didn't look to see that it had roundels on, did you? Anyway, I published articles on this in The Aeroplane in 1980, November, December, and then publishing it and more in a further copy of my book.
What happened to Amy then? She was shot down.
She was shot down, coming almost into land in England. The man parachuted into the water as they were hit by these blasted guns, and Amy landed the Oxford on the water. She jumped off the safe wing of the aircraft in the water where she was standing and went into the water where nobody could swim in. It was so rough and cold, she was frozen. And she went towards their boat, shouting, hurry, please hurry. She was swept under the moving boat, and we lost both of them. I must say, I felt straight away, knowing Amy and her wonderful courage. Although there was no question of this, apparently, in anybody else's mind, including Pauline, I was always in my heart, and I say heart, convinced that Amy was on a secret mission. Because she was that kind of person. She didn't join ATA for a long time. She was with the Army Co-op because she liked something a bit more dangerous and, more exciting. And this she would do for England. And she wanted to. And, poor darling, she'd done her worst bit, which was collecting the man. Presumably, I had a little man who was on the estuary who wrote to me about this. And he said he thought she was coming from well, Germany or, what's the name, or Holland, and of course they're next door to each other. It would be very easy. She was going to pick up a German to pop into Holland, and she would be easier for her to land and less dangerous. And although there was nobody else, I think, who really thought it, when I left Hatfield to go to Hamble, I was absolutely convinced, right to the end of the war, that she had been killed on a very important secret mission.
Did you discuss this with Pauline or anybody?
No. I thought it would be too hard for her. Pauline was a great friend of all her pilots, and Amy and everybody, and I never did. But when the war was over and I left, I was just as convinced as I was then, and that's when I started to look further.
Have you found it easy finding material?
I found a lot of people who were helpful, and the aeroplane, who just sent me a note, because I haven't bothered to have them lately, to say they can't send me any more copies if I don't pay. But that's because they think I'm going to write something else. They want me to, because they think I'm going to write something else. But I hope to do it if I get a republication of my book. And
what has been the response to your article on Amy Johnson?
Oh, quite a few people have written. Nothing except from the little man who was in the estuary of any great importance. I had a fight with the man who was head of the boat, because he wouldn't admit that they'd shot anything at first. And then he said, well, we were shooting at a German, and I put in my article, Amy's thing, he admitted that they were shooting at a German. I went around the German office, and there was no German aircraft in England in that vicinity, only in Wales part. And so he was shooting at Amy, and they really shot her down, and he wouldn't admit it. Poor devil, I got him to the thing of almost admitting they were shooting at a German when he died. I think it had hit him so hard that he'd had to admit this thing that I think he should have admitted straight away. But there we are.
What was said at the time about the death of Amy Johnson?
Oh, my dear, a list of things in the papers. Was she this? Was she taking someone? Was she... Oh, I mean, list of foot long in all the papers, and I have got it somewhere.
So there was a question at the time that she might have been involved on some...
I think in just a few of them, yes, there was. But you see, the government weren't going to admit it then, that this had happened, especially if it was a German, because... they didn't want Germany to be more angry with us than they were at the moment. So, there we are.
So was there any controversy at the time about what had happened to her?
Not as far as I know in Hatfield. But I knew so long, I mean, after all, the whole war was 5 years or something. And right at the end, I started to write my book, although it took some time to do. But I'm going to want to redo the Amy chapter, in which I want to put what I know on the secret mission side.
Was Amy Johnson the first loss to the women pilots?
Oh, no.
I wondered how the other pilots reacted to her death.
Oh, well, horrified, absolutely horrified. And that Amy could be so lost as to come down there when she was only going in the middle of England. That was the thing that they said, but I knew in my own mind what it meant, but it was only in my heart. I think it couldn't be in my brain. It was in my heart that I knew Amy had been.
What sort of effect would the fact that Amy might have been lost have upon the confidence of the other pilots?
Quite a bit, I'd think. I was in operations, and I put their ferry chits up when I'd done them, and they collected them off a board in the hall. And although I went into the mess sometimes, I wasn't a stalwart occupier of the mess, because I had my work to do. And although I knew all the pilots and I liked them very much and they quite liked me, I didn't, although Margot and I were living in a, oh dear little house then, yes. And I said to Margot, she must have been. She said, well, don't get over pressed about it, because she may not have been. even Amy.
You said there'd been other losses.
Yes, well, other people had not like that. We knew exactly what had happened to the other people. You know, they crashed or they went in the wrong airfield. I'm thinking also of Hamble, so I don't want Hatfield pilots to think, ooh, did we? But I'm thinking of, yes, there had been other losses.
Before Amy?
Yes, at Hatfield. And as I knew more than the other pilots, perhaps, where Amy was supposed to be, they perhaps weren't as surprised as I was, or as horrified as I was, and darling Pauline too, very, very horrified.
Can you tell me now what happened when you left Hatfield? How long were you operations officer at Hatfield for?
Ooh, I can't quite remember. Not longer, I would think, than 6 months or a year. I can't quite remember. But suddenly, Pauline came in and got Margot in there and told her that the men's pool at Hamble was being closed. I don't know why. I can only guess. Would she choose X number of pilots to go with her? And of course she chose me too. She did. She chose about 18 or 20 pilots, I think.
Why do you think the men's pool was being closed?
Well, I don't want to say this, but I wouldn't think, having been there, that it was madly efficient. But I wouldn't want to swear to that.
What was the feelings about having an all-woman pool?
Another one.
Was Hatfield all women?
Oh, yes. Oh, our bit of Hatfield was.
I see.
I don't think there were male... No, the male pilots were over at White Waltham, you see. The start of them. Yes.
So what were your feelings when you were asked to go to Hamble?
Oh, well, the exciting work. And it being nearer Germany than we were at Hatfield. And, all that. I mean, Margot having her own say. I being the absolute operations officer, which I was at Hatfield, but, you know, accepted. And she chose her pilots very carefully because she knew they had to start flying. And within days, Margot and Philippa Bennett went to the aviation school and started flying their first Blenheims. They were bombers, as you know, twin-engined, and they were the first. And this is the kind of thing that people at Hamble, all wartime aircraft, they were going to fly.